Welcome to ID the Future. I'm Andrew McDermott. Today our guest is philosopher of biology Paul Nelson, a senior fellow of the Discovery Institute's Centre for Science and Culture, and one of several ID theorists who travelled to London for a Royal Society meeting titled New Trends in Evolutionary Biology. Paul shared his insights and predictions with us before he left for the event, and we're catching up with him now to see what his thoughts are after the multi-day affair and ahead of an upcoming intelligent design conference in Cambridge called Beyond Materialism. Paul, thanks for connecting with us again.
It's a real treat.
So what was the atmosphere of the meeting? What did it feel like to be a participant?
It was quite lively, very well attended. I think that some of the talks were more valuable than others. That's always to be expected at a conference of this scope. But I'm interested to note, when I look back on my predictions, that in fact one of them came to pass, namely the two representatives of standard theory, Douglas Sutuma of the State University of New York at Stony Brook and Russ Landy of Imperial College, I believe, and the Norwegian University of Science and Technology, both, I think, with some justification, but perhaps unfairly, I can argue both sides of that, tended to trivialize the ideas being presented by the extended synthesis or alternative viewpoint. Frequently, both of them would comment when a speaker would present some new mechanism for evolution by saying, well, we knew about that a long time ago, and then give citations to the literature where some variant of the idea had previously been published. They both tended to diminish the significance of what was being said. And I think the sort of natural response to that is the criticisms that were leveled by the extended synthesis speakers were never really addressed either by Futuma or Landy. But it was quite lively. I've written some reports for the Evolution News and Views blog, and I'm going to be writing a follow-up to run in a few days where we look at or survey the main themes of the 3 days and how those relate to intelligent design. So I'm looking forward to putting that report together. I really enjoyed it. And we stayed very close to the Royal Society. So it was just a short walk from our hotel to the conference venue. People were quite cordial. It was a great time.
In one of your daily reports about the meeting, you said the specter of genuine agency as a cause of biological complexity hangs over almost everything happening at this meeting. Can you share with listeners just how the specter of intelligent design emerged halfway through?
When you have a live possibility, or at least another possibility for anything floating in the air, and you are sort of consciously putting it out of your mind, and I don't want to think about that, and I can't think about that. The way that human psychology works is we end up inevitably thinking about that. The thing that we try not to think about, we find ourselves thinking about whether we want to or not. So it was clear from many of the remarks that were made, and even from the slides that were shown, that the one alternative never to be considered was genuine design, that is, designed by a mind. Now, what's interesting is several of the speakers, in particular Andy Gardner of the University of St. Andrews, said the problem or the puzzle to be explained was the organized complexity of life. In fact, what Richard Dawkins calls their apparent design. So Gardner began his talk by showing a portrait of William Paley, the natural theologian. And on that same slide was a stone, a watch, and an anatomical representation of an eye, a camera eye. And Gardner said, Paley may have got the answer wrong in saying that an intelligent designer or a divine mind was responsible for biological complexity, but he certainly got the question right. And in other words, that is the question to be answered by anyone coming to explain eyes or ears or digestive systems or metabolic pathways. Pick any particular example of biological complexity, they would all work. So he gives his talk, and then the Q&A arrives, and Professor Tim Ingold of the University of Aberdeen, who was sitting fairly close to me, was very visibly agitated. He asked Gardner, are you saying that organisms are actually designed objects? Gardner replied in the affirmative, with some qualification about what the term design meant, but he didn't deny that he was arguing that organisms in fact represent something that we could justifiably call design. Well, Ingold became increasingly unhappy with this, and at one point nearly shouting at Gardner, "How is your explanation any different from that of Paley's?" Now, sometime in the near future, the listeners will be able to see this exchange for themselves because, or listen to it at any rate, because the Royal Society recorded the whole seminar and is going to make those recordings available online. But what struck me about the whole exchange was this, can't think of a better term, this psychological tension about the forbidden possibility, namely things look designed because in fact they are designed. That was not going to be considered. At a later discussion, Professor Evia Blanca of Tel Aviv University, who is probably the world's leading advocate of so-called neo-Lamarckian ideas of evolution, in a very lively presentation, she laid out these ideas and generated quite a bit of discussion. But during another discussion period, she said very loudly, I couldn't see her, but someone told me it was her, she said, "Well, we can consider lots of possibilities, but not God. We're excluding God." And she spoke the words that I'm sure other people were thinking, that one causal possibility, namely bona fide design by a mind, was not going to be considered. Well, again, I go back to the point I made a moment ago. When you actively exclude by, I guess, really an act of will, right? I'm not going to think about that. I'm not going to think about that. I'm not going to think about that. I'm not going to consider that. That thought then comes to dominate your mind. It's often joked that the straight-laced Victorians were in fact obsessed with sex because they, you know, covered the legs of pianos and chairs with lace, right? Because, well, it's a leg and they might think about a leg and very improper. So really, the healthier stance for the meeting would have been to say, well, there's this possibility of intelligent design. Let's weigh the evidence pro and con. And we can, if evolution has the explanatory power that is claimed, whether the neo-Darwinian version or the souped-up extended version, that theory will win in a fair fight. We can say we gave design a chance and it lost, and then we don't have to think about it anymore, right?
Right, which one could argue would be a more powerful way to dismiss intelligent design than to ignore it completely, or mention it in knee-jerk jesting fashion, as they did. So are they just protecting their careers and reputations, or do they genuinely think that natural selection is the best explanation for biological novelty?
I wouldn't say they're necessarily protecting their careers or reputations, although there may be some of that. I mean, so science is, among other things, a social enterprise conducted by fallible human beings. Rather, I would say perhaps a more helpful metaphor is if you're going to play a game, you have to have some rules. And for a long time now, really since the middle of the 19th century, design, real design by a non-human mind, however designated God, call it what you want, that's a violation. That's a violation of the rules of science. But the problem is we can perfectly well conceive that that's what actually happened. In fact, Darwin himself thought it was what actually happened prior to developing his theory of evolution by natural selection. So anytime you place a barrier in your mind around or between the ideas that you will consider and those that you will not, you still know what's on the other side of that line, right? You still know what's on the other side of that barrier. And the more powerful the evidence in front of you, and some very remarkable evidence was presented at the meeting, I hope to describe it in my write-up for Evolution News and Views, the more powerful that evidence, the attraction, forbidden or not, of the possibility of genuine design grows accordingly. So I think it would be a much better strategy if I were a Darwinian or an evolutionary theorist, where the evolution in question was materialistic. It would be a much better strategy to invite in the forbidden idea and refute it on its merits, right? Say, look, we gave you a chance and you just weren't as good as the theory we had. Here's a metaphor, maybe it's a little silly. Imagine you're in a softball league, right? And you say or claim that your team is the best in the league, but you know there's another team in your town that's a competitor, but you never play them. You know the team is there. Lots of people think that team is better. And you go around claiming, well, we're the best team in the league, and although we never play those guys. In fact, we're just not going to play them. There's something hollow. There's something suspect about the claim you're making about your prowess as an athletic organization. So I don't mean to get too psychological about this, but I just think it's intellectually more honest and in the long run actually more fun to take on all the live competitors, whether you like them or not, and let the best theory win. That's not what happened at the Royal Society, although what did happen, I think, was still of considerable merit and certainly worth the trip to London.
I appreciate you explaining that and using those analogies. That really helps people to understand. So do you feel like the meeting broke new ground at all? Did it encourage different thinking?
I think it did encourage different thinking, but let me suggest why I think ultimately it failed to solve the problems. The first speaker was an evolutionary theoretician from Austria named Gerd Müller. And he gave a wonderful, I think probably the best talk of the whole 3 days, a wonderful overview of where evolutionary theory stands today. And one of his slides, as he was sketching out this sort of eagle-eye view of the whole problem, was on what he called the explanatory deficits of the modern synthesis. So these are problems that need to be solved by any theory of evolution, or really more generally, any theory of origins. And he listed several of them, such as what explains causally phenotypic complexity, things like eyes and ears and body plans and the anatomical and structural details of living things that Darwin thought he had explained in 1859 with the process of natural selection. So there's one unsolved problem. And Muller's argument was textbook theory doesn't adequately account for this. His second bullet point was what explains phenotypic novelty, that is the origin of new forms throughout the history of life, such as we see, for instance, in the mammalian radiation, when the major orders of the mammals, such as cetacea or the bats or carnivores, enter the fossil record, or more dramatically, in Cambrian explosion itself, when you have the most but not all of the major animal body plans appearing more or less without antecedents. And that was also not explained by current theory. His third bullet point was what explains non-gradual forms or modes of transition where you see in the fossil record abrupt discontinuities between different types, and so on. So he listed these problems, and you could think of this as sort of pinning the puzzles to the wall and then saying, now what have we got that will solve these? So for the next 3 days then, various ideas, and some of them quite interesting, were about new mechanisms, new processes of evolution were proposed. But an objective assessment would be that certainly for the participants who came from the Discovery Institute and also from the UK and Europe, who are sympathetic to intelligent design, when we got together on Thursday after the conference had ended, after the Royal Society conference had ended, we felt almost to a person that the new mechanisms were not going to do the job. So in that sense, even though the meeting was very interesting, the puzzles that Gerd Müller laid out on Monday morning were still there on Wednesday evening when the conference came to a close. I've been a student of evolutionary theory and biology for almost 30 years now. And for most of the people who spoke, such as Dennis Noble, Avia Blanca, Gerd Müller himself, Jim Shapiro from the University of Chicago, and so forth, I've read their papers. I've followed their work for quite a long time. And while I admire their courage in breaking from neo-Darwinian orthodoxy, so to speak, I think that the phenomena, the puzzles, the evidence that they wish to explain will not yield to a naturalistic or materialistic framework, because the evidence itself gives clear markers, clear signals of having been caused by a mind. In fact, you will never solve a problem if you have put out of reach, philosophically, put out of reach its true explanation. In that sort of situation, you're doomed to unhappiness, you're doomed to failure. So I think we came with the attitude, let's learn what we can, interact with as many people as we can. But I don't think any of us really expected to see these problems solved by the new mechanisms that were being proposed. And some of them were new, others have been around for a while.
Mm. Listeners can read more of your coverage and other folks who have joined in on this trip at evolutionnews.org. And Paul, it's always great to speak with you. You have a great way of explaining things, and I appreciate your time today.
Wonderful. Thanks for having me.
For ID the Future, I'm Andrew McDermott. Thanks for joining in.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2016. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org or idthefuture.com.